talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Dublin's industrial heritage from Sandy Mount Strand to Crumlin Road. A new oral history archive of Irish show people involved in everything from circuses to travelling cinemas. The 400-year contest for power between Britain and China. And to end the show, Irish settlers and the history of the Native Americans. You can send us your thoughts and comments, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with Dublin's industrial heritage. A new book is the first in a three-volume series unpacking the history of Dublin's industrial heritage down through the ages, with each book covering a specific geographical area. So Volume 1 will be looking at Dublin Southeast, Volume 2 will be looking at Dublin Southwest, and Volume 3, North Dublin City and Suburbs. And it's published in paperback by Wordwell. The author of Volume 1, Rob Goodbody. And Rob, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks very much.
Can I ask why you decided to begin with Dublin Southeast? What's so significant there?
All three of those areas have a lot of industrial history in them. But the Southeast certainly has, as you've seen in the book, there's an awful lot. It might be just worthwhile pointing out, just for listeners who are not familiar with industrial heritage, that it's not just an industry, it's not just factories. Industrial heritage includes everything from mining and quarrying through mills and factories to transport, canals, railways, communications, and for sometimes even military installations. So I've included the various gun batteries and barracks and stuff in it as well.
And windmills, because I think some people will be surprised to learn that Dublin had windmills.
Yes, there's still one left in the Thomas Street. And there was another one that was there up until about 1970. I think fairly evidently Windmill Lane, just off Sir John Rogerson's Quay. But there was quite a few then outside the city, what was then the city, in these what's now the southern suburbs. They were mainly pumping water out of quarries as power source for doing that, because groundwater comes into quarries and needs to be pumped out. So yeah, there was about 12 of them listed within that southeast area.
And your book covers everything from bakeries to brickfields. And I think by looking at these everyday industries, you get a sense of how ordinary lives were shaped by them. The fact that I think Sandy Mount was once called Brickfield Town.
Yes, it was the source of bricks for much of Georgian Dublin up to a certain point, when there was a law was passed to ban it for environmental grounds, because within a certain distance of the city, the smoke from brick kilns was not particularly pleasant. So, but yes, we've maps in the middle of the 18th century which show brick fields in the Sandy Mount area.
And talk to me about the evolution of the Docklands area, because it seems to have gone from fishing and boat building to becoming a hub of warehouses and milling, and then moved from that into tech and finance.
Yes, it's and it's moved physically over the years as well, because obviously it started with the medieval Dublin in the area far upstream from where it is now. And but by the 18th century, the docks as we have along North Wall Quay and Sir John Rogerson's Quay came into play, because all the land along there was reclaimed from the Liffey and from Dublin Bay. And with technology changes, the whole dockland thing changed, going from smaller boats into bigger ships, into the steam age, and the size of ships and what they could carry and what they were bringing in out. But as the ships got bigger and more land was reclaimed down the river for what's now Dublin Port, the earlier bits along Sir John Rogerson's Quay and North Wall Quay were abandoned by the docks. And so industry shut down. I mean, the biggest one in the southeast would have been the gasworks, but there was coal importers and all sorts of things. So that meant there was a lot of vacant and underused land. And as recently as the 1980s, the whole project for changing that into something other than dockland came to be. So we had that whole program for renewing the whole Docklands area that's led to such incredible changes over such a short period.
There was a man with the unfortunate name of Thomas Grubb, but he seems to have been hugely successful and established a factory to manufacture machine tools and telescopes, and he developed an international reputation. And then his son took over and invented, or certainly was involved in developing, the periscope for the first submarine.
He was, yeah. The Grubbs, they produced mirrors for telescopes, but including astronomical telescopes. So within Ireland, the Burr telescope, which was biggest in the world for a long time, the mirror there came from Grubbs, but others came to astronomical observatories all over the world. But yes, they started into periscopes for submarines, which eventually was the demise of the business here in Dublin, because with the First World War, and Ireland was seen by Britain as not being the best security place for having things as important as periscopes. So it shut down and moved out to England. But yes, we've quite a bit of pioneering work going on in Dublin in the industrial heritage scope.
Robert Kane seems to have been a hugely influential figure in the 19th century in harnessing water power and in, I suppose, developing Ireland's and Dublin's industrial story.
Yeah, he was more proposing than what actually happened. He wrote a seminal book on industrial heritage in the 1840s, and it was a kind of a reaction to the scope of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, that and Ireland was getting left behind. So in his book, he estimated that we have enough water power in Ireland to run all the industry we'd need to run, and we could be self-sufficient in industry. And it unfortunately wasn't taken up, because the, I suppose, flexibility of having steam engines wherever you wanted them rather than where there was adequate water power, the steam engines won out in the end. But he did a huge amount to record what we had in industrial heritage at that time in the 1840s. He was heavily involved with University College Cork there, so he's commemorated down in UCC.
Tell me about the postal service then as well, because it was in development over many centuries, but you really, and you see the installation of the letterboxes and so on, but it seems to have been somewhat haphazard until things were coordinated more centrally.
Yes, we've had, initially it was more government communications in the postal service, but gradually from the 17th century was opened up to bringing private mail and commercial mail. And there was two different systems, one for local and one for nationwide or sending abroad. And in the 18th century, those two were run by the same organisation but still kept separate. And if we think of the GPO so fondly as being in O'Connell Street, but originally was in Dame Street and then in College Green before it moved to O'Connell Street. And even after it moved in O'Connell Street, they thought of moving it again, but kept it where it was and enlarged it. So that's when everything got centralized into a single postal system in 1840, where now penny post took you anywhere within Britain and Ireland. Before that, you paid by the distance it traveled, initially on horseback, and then with mail coaches.
And Anthony Trollope involved in the story of those letterboxes.
He was. He was. He worked for the post office here in Ireland for many years, and before going back to Britain. And yes, he introduced the earliest post boxes into Ireland and indeed in Britain.
So, what would you like readers to take away from this story about Dublin's industrial heritage? Do you want people to look at the city differently?
I think so. Yeah, I think. Well, one thing that I hear so frequently, because I lead guided walks here and there, and one thing that kind of disturbs me is the amount of that people credit Britain for doing so much for us. And I'm trying to put it across how much Irish people were doing this. Most commonly, I hear how the British built all our railway systems. Well, our railway systems were built by Irish companies with Irish contractors and Irish engineers. And we don't give ourselves as much credit as we need to for what was done, not just in the railways, but in business in general and industrial works too. So, that's what I would like. I haven't trumpeted that in the book, but I think it reads for itself that how much was done within the southeast area and by implication elsewhere in the country in relation to providing railways, canals, businesses, factories, all that kind of thing.
Well, it's a brilliant new book, and it's the first volume of a proposed three-part series. But the first one is the one that's available right now. It's called Dublin's Industrial Heritage, From Sandymount Strand to Crumlin Road. It's published in paperback by Wordwell. The author is Rob Goodbody. And Rob, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
A new digital oral history archive celebrates the lives and legacy of Irish showpeople. Voices of the Showmen captures two centuries of stories from travelling families who brought variety, circus, cinema, sideshows and fairs to communities across Ireland. And it's the result of a partnership between the University of Galway Library and the Irish Street Arts Circus and Spectacle Network, the Irish Showman's Guild and Archives Ireland. And to talk to me about the project, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Barry Houlihan, who's the archivist at the University of Galway Library. Barry, you're very welcome.
Great, thanks so much, Patrick.
Well, can you tell us about this archive, and can you tell us about the work that's still ongoing as you're gathering and collecting all of these contributions?
Yeah, sure. It's a wonderful project to be part of, and it's a long time in the making. We've been talking with IFACS, which is the Irish Street Arts and Circus and Spectacle Network, and with the Irish Showman's Guild, just trying to think about how we could work to preserve this really important archive, this really important heritage, and see what would be the best method to do that. It's a huge physical archive out there scattered among the various families in the guild, but we needed a starting point and we needed a beginning, really, and we thought oral history should be a way to do that. And with thanks to the Heritage Council, they have funded this project, this Voices of the Showmen, and that's our beginning. And it's more than important. It's actually quite urgent that it's happening right now, that we were able to record all over Ireland with members of the Irish Showman's Guild community and be able to record their stories, their voices, their memories. And that's something really important, and it's a great beginning.
So talk to me about some of the contributors, people like Harry McFadden, Marion Daniels King. Talk about their lived experience of the travelling life.
Yeah, I mean, it's been wonderful. I spoke with both recently, both with Harry and with Marion. I mean, both of advanced age, but both from such incredible lineages and legacies in different parts of the Showman's Guild community. And even within that, perhaps important just to even just give listeners a breakdown of the various groups within that. We have going back to the era of the fit-ups, back to travelling cinemas, fairgrounds, fun fairs, circus, all those various art forms and crafts and traditions within the Showman's Guild. And one thing that's come through all the conversations that I've been part of so far, and a lot more still to do, is it's just how adaptive the community was and how resilient they were to those changing tastes of audiences, changing things within the state that had to maybe necessitate change. And that all came out in those conversations with Harry and with Marion recently. And even in Harry's example and with the McFadden's example there, he was speaking about, starting out in the era of silent movies. You know, so this is what we're going back to, the era of the silent films before the talkies were a thing. And in those conversations, Harry was talking about, you know, the film stars of the international screen that he was literally bringing into every parish around all of Ireland. People like Charlie Chaplin and later Buster Keating, these great names and icons of early cinema. And literally bring them directly into rural communities, towns and village halls. That transition then into the talkies and what that brought to people. It was a change there for people to, see a different type of film in their community. And the same with Marion in her background as well. Just being really on the road and bringing entertainment and fit-ups and these shows directly all over Ireland. So it was wonderful to speak with them. And each of them has such a truly unique and interesting story. That's part of Ireland's wider heritage.
Yeah, exactly. Part of Ireland's wider heritage, that this is such an important part of our national culture and history. And if we don't gather these testimonies now, then they're going to be lost for future generations. And a hugely important part of our history will be lost, because this is about how people were entertained, and this is how our society operated across these years.
Mm-hmm. It did. And the oral history, coming back to that as a process to begin this with, and, you know, only to speak and not to speak really on behalf of the showman's community, but they have lost people, so key to them and so dear to them in recent years. And had this began 2-3 years ago, even 5 years ago, you know, there would be a lot of really key people there whose stories would have been so important. These were another senior generation back. You're going back pre-independence Ireland here, going back to a very different time. And their lived experience of being on the road within Ireland and touring entertainment and gathering the communities together, families of all ages as well. This is what was coming through recently, just that event we held recently at the University of Galway, where we had Marion and Harry speak. And, you know, Marion talking about, you know, lighting of the tilly lamps, you know, around the village leading up to the hall where people would come and see the show, literally lighting a path for families to come and view these shows. And there'd be a sense of expectation as well. People would know that the show would be coming at a particular day in a particular week. And people would gather. They would bring each other, tell neighbours and friends. And there'd certainly be all ages there. And that's such a wonderful part of when these travelling shows were certainly one of the primary forms of entertainment for communities, not just rural communities, but in towns and in villages as well. And for, I think, you know, part of the wider archives we have here in University of Galway, you know, we've so much there of Irish theatre and performance generally. But this was a gap. And I think that's a wider gap nationally about that touring history of our shows, of the fit-ups and circus and through to present day as well. And it's just, I think, really important we're able to capture that now.
And some wonderful photographs. There's a wonderful image from 1875 that was provided by Tom Duffy Circus, and you see them all outside there. I suppose the one of the big stands, and you see the people involved, and it really just captures a kind of a different era. It's like something from The Greatest Showman.
It is. I mean, that was wonderful to have that photo as part of the event, and speaking with the Duffy family. At that event here in Galway, they recreated it more recently, and they were explaining how they did that. And of course, that's, you know, another generation down today, multiple generations down today, when they were able to recreate that photograph. And that's special, and that shows that lineage, that tradition of what this has been part of in terms of Irish culture and heritage, truly for generations. But I think perhaps unremembered in certain ways. I think just by the form that it is, the art and craft that it is, there's such a rich oral tradition there, and perhaps its physical record is more fragmented, more distributed, perhaps not kept at all. So oral history, I think, has just been that way for us to navigate into that history. And I'm just so grateful for the showman's community and ISAC to partner with us here at the university to allow us to record it, first of all, with Archives Ireland, but then preserve it for the future and share it. That's going to be, I think, the great outcome of this project.
Exactly. So let's talk about the sharing, because there was that wonderful launch event, and then it's all going to be made available online later in the year through the University of Galway Library website.
Yeah. So our digital team here in the library, part of the Heritage Collections team, so we'll be working with them, and we'll process all the recordings when they come to us here, and then they'll all be made freely available on the University of Galway Library digital repository. And they'll sit alongside a lot of other oral histories that we've been building here in recent years. Colleagues of mine working on Irish Mhaire Cairns oral history, partnering with the Galway International Arts Festival on oral histories there. So this is, I think, a really exciting development, is building this living archive, the voices of our living heritage and culture.
And I think Galway is the perfect place to host it, because there are such strong links between the university and the performing arts in various collections, but also, I suppose, between Galway as a city and as a county.
It is. I mean, we're spoiled. Yeah, we've just come through the this year's Galway International Arts Festival here, but it's all year round in all sorts of media of arts and culture here. And within the archives here, the performing arts are certainly a real strength of ours. I mean, you could list off endless amounts of people who are fortunate to host their archives. Galway's Druid Theatre, 50 years this year. The Arts Festival, as I mentioned. But it's bilingual as well. So we have the archives of Tyvek na Gáilge approaching their centenary in 28. The Abbey Theatre, of course, in Dublin. The Gate, the Lyric in Belfast. So we have this all-island bilingual archive of Irish theatre and performance. But yet, as I mentioned, this work of the travelling shows and of the Showman's Guild, a really important part, and bringing their voices and documenting their voices into that national record, really, of culture and heritage of performance, is something very special.
And people mightn't be aware that there is an Irish Showman's Guild, or that there is this Irish street art circus and spectacle network. But, you know, very important work representing the different performers and people involved, but also making sure that their history and contribution to entertaining Irish families for centuries is remembered, is documented, and is preserved.
Yeah. I mean, the groups that you mentioned there, the Guild and IFAX, I mean, they're so important for the current generation, the contemporary artists and touring shows within that, just for advocacy and recognition and support, but as well as ensuring that there are this great circle and network of artists for the future. We still do have to look back and, I think, definitely gather more and be more aware of this is part of Ireland's wider culture. It's a way of bringing it out of maybe, not quite obscurity, but certainly into a more mainstream way of recognising that it is such an important part of our theatre tradition, our performance, our music, song, circus and live and visual arts together. So all those parts will, I think, marry each other very well through this oral history, and will blend in with our other archives here at the university.
So people will be able to just maybe type in a location, or type in a particular maybe a circus or performer or something, and they'll be able to find out details about it, these travelling cinemas, the fairgrounds, the circuses, the sideshows and so on, that it'll be a great way of just, in a bit like the census, just doing a search and seeing what you might find.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's going to be one of the exciting outcomes of it, is that, and this is what you get with oral history as well, it's places and it's people and it's dates and memories. So as well as being able to listen to all this, generating transcripts allows us to create greater searchability through literally searching the words that people talk about. Colleagues across the team then will do really detailed work in the metadata that is really highlighting the key terms and tags, like, as you say, exactly, places, locations, performers, and just allow the public, they won't see any of that, but just when they search, they'll have a very seamless experience being able to delve into and uncover these really rich and vibrant histories of the Showman's Guild.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Barry Houlihan, the archivist at the University of Galway Library, for joining me tonight to talk to me about this wonderful new digital oral history archive, Voices of the Showman. Thank you, Barry.
Great. Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. The relationship between Britain and China has shaped the modern world. Chinese art, philosophy and science have had a profound effect on British culture, while the long history of British exploitation is still bitterly remembered in China today. But how has their interaction changed over time? Well, it's all explored in a brilliant new book, The Great Reversal: Britain, China and the 400-Year Contest for Power. The book is published in hardback by Yale University Press. The author is Kerry Brown. And Kerry, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much.
Can we tell us about your own background and how you approached it as both a former diplomat and as professor of Chinese studies at King's College London?
Certainly. So I first went to China in 1991, and then I lived there in the mid-1990s as an English teacher, but learning Chinese. I learned Chinese properly when I came back to Britain. And then I was a diplomat for about 7 years. Half that time I was spending in China. Afterwards, I worked as an academic in Australia and then back in Britain, and have probably visited China about 100 times in addition to the 7 years I lived there. So I've grown to regard it almost as my second home. And the reason why I wrote this book was I'd often thought and heard Chinese people telling me about the experiences that they had as being colonized and being treated sort of badly by the British in the past. They had a narrative in their head. And I realized as British, we didn't really have a story about our relationship with China, although there was plenty of things that happened between our two countries and a big, big influence that you just referred to between us. And I thought it would be good to put in one book that story from the very beginning over 450 years ago, right down till today.
And it's interesting when you go back to the beginning of the relationship, Britain knew quite a lot about China and perhaps more than the other way around. And there were also problems maybe from the beginning in terms of suspicion and mistrust and misunderstandings.
Certainly. I mean, it was mostly tradespeople going to China at the very beginning in the first couple of hundred years, not really political contact. And it was very controlled on the Chinese side. They could eventually only really do business through what is today Guangdong, but was then called Canton. And so kind of very limited contact with a very limited group of people who were not necessarily interested in China for itself, but were interested in business opportunities. Really, that changed right at the beginning of the 18th century. Very famous mission to China with Lord Macartney, who'd previously been the ambassador to Russia, tried to really create a better link between Britain and China, but wasn't very successful. But it did create a lot of knowledge in Britain about China's kind of culture, its language, its civilization, and a lot of appreciation. So, you know, we kind of had an awareness that there was this enormously important power, enormously different culture. And many people in Britain, you wouldn't expect Samuel Johnson, the writer, you know, kind of Oliver Goldsmith, the writer, you know, they often kind of referred to China in their works. It wasn't a kind of completely unfamiliar thing, but it was often very idealistic, not very kind of well thought through, because there was very, very limited person-to-person contact.
And there definitely seems to have been a clash of world views in that time, say, up till about 1830. And that's perhaps the reason why some of these diplomatic missions failed.
Indeed, I think that the relationship between Britain and China was regarded as the sort of the ultimate East meets West, if you can call it that. It's somewhat crude, but, you know, kind of two very, very distinctive views of the world. One based on a sort of Judaic Christian view of the world, very, very united behind this sort of Christian ideology. And the second, way more hybrid. I mean, the Chinese view of the world always mystified Europeans, not just British, but Germans and others, because of this hybridity. What were these people? They were Taoists, they were Confucianists, they were, you know, Buddhists. They kind of had very, very different worldview. And certainly when missionaries went to China, Italian missionaries like Matteo Ricci, they really found China a big mystery, a big puzzle, because it also seemed very ancient culture. And that seemed to go against what the Bible said, as they believed, which was, you know, the world only existed for 6,500 years. And so you had these contorted arguments about how it was that you could have this very ancient-looking civilization but still sit in a kind of Christian time frame. So all sorts of issues that were never really easy to solve and certainly weren't solved at that time and sort of overshadow us to this day. You know, the differences between China's worldview and the Western worldview is still very much present in our lives.
So let's talk about the wars then in the 19th century. You call them the Anglo-Chinese Wars in the book. I think you mentioned that the Chinese still refer to them as the Opium Wars. And how did opium become such a source and cause of conflict?
So the British sourced many things in China through the East India Company, principally. That was the one that had monopoly, established in 1600. And they bought tea in huge amounts, silk, porcelain, till the technology was copied by the British. But really, that created a massive trade imbalance. Basically, British traders were giving silver bullion to China and taking goods away, and the Chinese were accruing these. There was a sort of massive issue about what could Britain sell to China in order to at least recoup some of this capital. Well, unfortunately, opium was the thing that they discovered they could sell in vast amounts. It was illegal, but it was something that British traders got involved with. Companies which still exist today, Jardine, although it's some, you know, kind of only a very brief period, but they were involved in this trade right back in the early 19th century. vast amounts of trading in opium. And so in the 1830s, the Chinese government realized the addiction to this was causing massive problems in China, and they tried to clamp down on it. I call them the Anglo-Chinese Wars rather than the Opium Wars, because it wasn't just about opium, although that was very significant. There was also the real desire of the British to try and have formal government links with China, and they just couldn't make this happen. And that's why they enforced it upon the Chinese that there should be a formal link, because until then, they'd only really been able to create a kind of commercial links and weren't able to deal with some of the more complicated issues that had an, obviously had an impact on the economics.
And it gets complicated because you have the First War and then you have the Second War. And it seems that during the Second War, Britain gets, you know, huge power and control in China.
Yes, Britain's technological advantages, the fact that it was able to have almost complete freedom from Chinese law. I mean, British citizens in China were not accountable to Chinese law, but to British law, so extraterritoriality. Kind of issues around the massive benefits that Britain's navy then gave it meant that by 1856 and 1860, when the Second War happened, you know, Britain had all the cards. It was also joined by the French and the Russians, so that made it a stronger alliance. But in addition, at that time, China was riven by a massive rebellion, Taiping Rebellion, which had divided the country, brought it almost close to civil war, and maybe killed over 20 million people. So it was very, very weak. That would probably be the low point of modern Chinese history.
You make an interesting point in the book about how these events in this period seems to be better understood or better remembered in China, whereas there isn't really what you describe as the corresponding tale being told and being taught in British schools or in Britain.
Yes, it's a kind of a major sort of shift. You mentioned earlier that it was British going to China for much of the early 350 years of history. But in the last 30 years, it's all shifted the other way. Way more Chinese come here as tourists, as students, 150,000 students at one point. And so, you know, that kind of created a lot of knowledge about Britain by Chinese. Many Chinese speak English. And so British people, their knowledge levels about China have never been great. But now they're really, really in the shadow because of the amount of effort Chinese have put into their knowledge levels about Britain and other Western countries. And so, you know, one of the reasons why I think British people don't appreciate the real significance of their relationships with China is simply because of this knowledge gap. Many people in Britain think that China is, you know, almost unknowable. It's got a very different language, different culture. Not a huge number of British people, you know, have gone to China. It's still regarded as slightly mysterious, you know, mysterious political system, mysterious leaders. And I think that that has created this mystique that maybe intimidates people. This book, I think, is really an attempt to say, no, it's not a mysterious thing. It's a very, very accessible history. It's a very human history. And it was, you know, kind of lots and lots of different British and Chinese and other people contributed to this history. We can definitely know it better.
The story in the 20th century is also fascinating because you have a revolution in China in 1911, but Britain seems to be able to adapt to that and work its way around it. And even when China later in the century becomes communist, Britain is again able to perhaps manage those relationships while still balancing their ties with the United States.
Indeed, what really kind of necessitated that was our ongoing interest in Hong Kong. Whatever happened, Hong Kong, which had been leased or ceded to Britain in different ways over the latter part of the 19th century. Now, by the 20th century, it was a crown colony, it was under colonial control. It's been more and more successful as a trading hub, as a port, and Britain really wanted to maintain that. In the Second World War, from 41 to 45, the Japanese occupied Hong Kong. At the end of it, there was a real possibility that then Hong Kong would just revert to Chinese rule. The British, through diplomatic tactics and actually opposing the Americans, who weren't keen on it maintaining its empire. I mean, Roosevelt, had he lived, would probably have stopped this, but his successor was less kind of fixated by this problem. So Britain maintained their colonial control over Hong Kong right down to 1997. So no matter what happened in Beijing, Britain dealt with the government in Beijing because it had to, because of its interests in Hong Kong.
What happens then afterwards? Because there does seem to be a shift in the power balance and the relationship. And as Britain becomes much weaker and China becomes much stronger, you very much see a reversal of perhaps the relationship and how they interacted with each other.
Yes, I mean, in the book I refer to these four big areas: military, economic, cultural and technological. And in all of them, Britain really has become a lesser power than China. I mean, this is not to denigrate Britain, still a significant economy and military power, but China has really grown in unexpected ways. And so economically, you know, Britain had a bigger economy than China's until 2005. Now I believe that China's is about six times the size of the British economy. Militarily, I mean, China has the world's largest navy in terms of vessels, even if not technologically. I mean, Britain doesn't have anything like that capacity. And so it's a very unequal relationship now. But I mean, for a lot of the 20th century, because of Hong Kong, Britain had real leverage in China. It was a significant power. And uniquely, of all of the major powers, it had representation in Beijing from 1950. You know, the French didn't have anything until 1964. The Americans didn't start formal links until 1979. And so Britain really has this unbroken record of being present in China and working in China. And I think that is something unique about our, you know, her story as a major Western country with China, that we were the ones that maintained the links no matter what. And that should count for something today, because, you know, obviously a lot of other relationships are not so long-term, not so sustained. We see in Britain, you know, today, well, we've seen China today, companies like Rolls-Royce that were present in China from the early 1960s, even the Cultural Revolution. Britain, you know, from 1966 did have representation in China despite massive turbulence. I often think things are difficult today, big issues between China and America, China and Britain. But in fact, in the past, things were actually worse. You know, there were real moments of violence and clashes, even up to the 1960s. And that history should tell us we've been in difficult places, we've got through them. So we should take solace from that and know that we will always have a relationship, even if it's a very tough one.
A relationship, even if it's a very tough one. And you do note as well in your conclusion that China is a country that has affected Britain profoundly. It's had a profound impact on Britain and the United Kingdom. But yet there isn't a clear narrative about the country.
Yes, I mean, China has a British narrative. It's, as you said earlier, about colonization, about Britain forcing China in the 19th and 20th century to have what it called unequal treaties. And, you know, there's a lot of humiliation and resentment about that history. But Britain also has a China story.
Well, the book is called The Great Reversal, Britain, China and the 400-Year Contest for Power. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. The author is Kerry Brown. And Kerry, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. A new T.G. Cahir documentary, Éire agus na Chéad Náisiún, Ireland and the First Nations, explores our role in the creation of the United States and to a lesser extent Canada. Not just through our eyes, but through the eyes of the people the Irish settlers displaced and at times attacked, even massacred. And so to discuss the documentary, I'm delighted to welcome Ronan McCluskey, the producer. Ronan, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Can I begin with what inspired you to make this documentary?
Well, do you know, actually, I was reading a book about the Lakota, who had formerly been known as the Sioux, but they're actually called the Lakota. And I just started to notice, you know, you'd notice, God, there's an Irish name and there's an Irish name. First name was a man called McLaughlin, who had overseen the death of Sitting Bull. And then it was a guy called Gentles, who had been responsible for the murder of Crazy Horse. I just started thinking, God, there's all these Irish names. Then you started thinking, well, there must have been a lot of Irish people around at that time. And then that just gave me the idea for doing a documentary that would look at our interactions really over, you know, the course of our interactions with the Native Americans from, like, you know, earlier times. So really the first story we focused on is William Johnston, who emigrates to America in the 1700s. So really the documentary looks at the interactions between the Irish and the Native Americans between the mid-1700s up until the Wounded Knee, which happens in 1890.
And William Johnston is such a crucial figure, and yet he's virtually unknown here in Ireland, even though he had such a major role to play in the development of America. Can you tell us about him and his career?
Do you know what? He is one of the most idiosyncratic, unique, out-of-time characters from Irish history, and yet he is completely unknown here. And perhaps the reason for that is that his story just doesn't fit our what was happening in our consciousness. He goes to America, gets great success at a time when the rest of Ireland is obviously suffering. And obviously he's with all these Native American characters. He becomes a chief amongst the Mohawk. His story is so otherly that it just doesn't land back home in Ireland. It just doesn't, people just don't know what to make of it. So he seems to kind of disappear. He is the inspiration for Last of the Mohicans. Well, he's said to be the inspiration for Last of the Mohicans. Some people say he's the first modern American, and that he's the first European to travel to America and leave behind his European identity. So he is this, and he dresses in a mixture of, you know, British clothing, you know, the kind of traditional European clothing, and Native American clothing. He speaks their languages. He eventually gets married to one of their most influential women, Molly Brandt. And in the Mohawk, the women are actually very influential. So the woman pick who's going to be the chief. So in marrying this Native American woman, he really creates this power couple. Like, they really are the most powerful people on the eastern coast of America at that time. He becomes a general in the British Army. With his sway amongst the Mohawk, he manages to help cause the collapse. He more or less brings around the collapse of Montreal, which means the collapse of New France and the creation of Canada. So in a way, he changes the map of the world. There are rumours that he has scores of children. So he leaves him a big genetic imprint as well. He, you know, he really is this incredible character. But then, of course, he dies just before the Declaration of Independence. And he has got the Mohawk to side on the side of the British. And once the US state is created, that's their downfall. And many of the Mohawk are then driven into Canada. So ultimately, he kind of brings about the demise of the Mohawk in North America. But it's incredible story.
And a wonderful book by Fintan O'Toole, White Savage, a few years back. And I think it hasn't resonated, the story. And is that because we're perhaps maybe a little uncomfortable with some of these aspects of our past? The fact that we have all of these interactions with these indigenous tribes in the United States, and sometimes it was a healthy relationship and sometimes it was a deeply dark and unpleasant and violent one.
I mean, even William Johnson, there's reports that, we didn't really feature this in the documentary, just didn't have time to make it a complete documentary about him. And, you know, there's stuff that's, you know, it's obviously such a different time, and there's stuff about William Johnson that you just think, God, that's, you know, he's just living in a different time. And it's, I mean, Fintan O'Toole's book is brilliant, and it was published in 2006. And yet, amazingly, nobody pitched a documentary from it or made a documentary and said, God, have you heard about this great character? Even despite Fintan's book, and I actually accidentally met him on a plane and we had a conversation about it, he was saying that he was surprised that it just didn't resonate more amongst the public. And the book's brilliant, you know. And actually, in North America, like, there's massive reconstructions in New York State, and the central character is William Johnson. There's like two of his houses are maintained as state monuments or state museums. Do you know, he's really well known in New York State. There's massive reenactments around him, and yet he's forgotten here. And there is a dark side to it as well. You know, it's a bloody time. And yeah, there's other aspects of it as well, where maybe him and his wife had slaves and stuff like this, or enslaved people. There's light and dark within the story.
And we tend to like to celebrate the story of Irish people who go off and help make America, and they help build it, and they play such significant roles. And perhaps we're less comfortable with some of the darker figures and these more violent contributions. And you see that in the period after the creation of the United States with some of the generals like Philip Sheridan, and, you know, the dispossession of the Native Americans and some of the wars against them.
Yeah, which were, you know, Sheridan is really the architect of, you know, the campaign against the Plains Indians. So really, yeah, then from the early to mid 1800s onwards, the settlers want to move westward. They want states like Montana, Dakota, all these places. And of course, they are very proud, very strong, very warlike tribes in those places. And Sheridan is quite typical of a mass movement of Irish people who joined the Civil War on the side of the North. And they come out of the Civil War and they're kind of celebrated. And all of a sudden, Irish people have found a role in American society through the army. And then Sheridan in particular is, I think he is the first five-star general. He's certainly the most senior person in the army at that time, or, you know, one of the most senior within, you know, the... He's certainly one of the top generals in America at that time. And then he is then given the role of taking on the Plains Indians. And of course, one of the things he realizes from Ireland, he realizes that in Ireland, once we lost the potato, we were so dependent on one crop, our society collapsed. And he realized that the Native Americans were dependent on the buffalo. So a lot of the treaties had promised the Native Americans that the land would be theirs while the buffalo still roamed on it. So, of course, he was part one of the people who architected this. He was the architect of this idea of, well, if we get rid of the buffalo, we get rid of the Native American.
And you mentioned the famine there and the lessons learned from it. And, of course, we had people like the Choctaw helping to send donations during that time. And there was also stories of great empathy and great support.
Yeah, and actually... the Choctaw thing, and actually there's a man called Waylon Whitedeer, who is a Choctaw elder and an incredible artist who has been living in the Donegal Gaeltacht on and off for about 20 years. So he really knows Ireland. And he is brilliant in the documentary talking about it. It is this gift across time, really, between two people who suffered. It is this, you know, really precious moment where one suffering people put their hand out to another suffering people. But again, actually, one of the things about the documentary is that it shows the two sides of our soul, which I guess can still be seen today. Like, there's part of us can really empathize with different people and say, oh, God, we see their suffering. And then there's another part of us can't. And I think it shows our, I suppose, within all humanity, our ability to both, you know, be gentle and kind and also to attack and kill, you know.
Talk to me about some of the brilliant contributors to the documentary. For example, the cultural geographer Dakota Goodhouse, because you really bring together scholars who are expert on these areas and who have been working on these parts of their own story for many years.
Yeah, do you know, funny, the documentary, we started it at a time when obviously then you're starting to get very conscious of things like cultural appropriation. And in no part of the documentary does an Irish person ever say anything about the beliefs of a Native American tribe. So we talk, Irish historians and commentators, we talk about our side of the story. But then when we come to talk about the Mohawk or whatever, we've Mohawk elders giving us that side of the story. So I knew when I was kind of doing my research, you know, the way in Ireland, we've people like Lilith O'Leary, you know, we've so many people like that who have such knowledge about Irish culture. And I kind of knew I wanted to get the equivalent people amongst these kind of Native American tribes. And it was just a case of contacting people and seeing who'd written books and stuff. Probably the first person who I really came in contact with was a guy called Dakota Goodhouse. And his family have been historians for the Hunkpapa tribe since the 1700s, who are part of the Lakota. And he is this incredible person who has recreated maps according to their worldview with their place names. You know, it's basically the same kind of stuff we have, where you kind of know that, like, you know, Derry means the oak grove, and like he knows what all the original, the words, what they meant. He knows all about their cosmology, about how they believe the what we call the Big Dipper, they see as the five original Lakota who come down. He talks a lot about things like White Buffalo Calf Woman, who is this woman who appears to Lakota around 900 AD, and she gives him the pipe. And that's where they create their idea of being the Lakota, and the pipe gives them that sense of enlightenment. So we're talking about their origin story and our origin story. So we've got an amazing guy amongst the Mohawk, a guy called, his name in English is Tom Porter. But he, ironically, the Mohawk guy who's from the border between America and Canada, he was one of the strongest native speakers there. You could see he really knew the Mohawk language, and that was his first language. But his name means the one who wins. But he was like meeting, you know, It's, you know, there was such spirituality about him, such empathy. And actually, he talked a lot about his empathy for Irish culture. Do you know what I mean? So while we were meeting all these people, and then actually over time, they would start to say, oh, I've been reading, I've actually always been interested in Irish culture. And certainly when we were in Browning, Montana, which is the Blackfeet area, so many of them were kind of, oh, you're Irish. Like they, that really meant something to them to be Irish. And a number of Irish people had married into the Blackfeet tribe. And they had this real sense of like, oh, we relate to Irish people. It wasn't, oh, you know, and yeah. So I think we have a fascination with them, and I certainly think they, many of them also, whilst they're primarily Native American, a lot of them did see something in Irishness that they could relate to.
What I also thought very interesting is that this isn't just an historical story. There are so many resonances and parallels with today. There are so many messages that we can take from this and apply to our own world.
Yeah, in many ways, the Irish people are going out there and the machine has started. The machine is going to remove these people from the land and they're going to turn it into a place where settlers can build their lives. And Irish people join that machine. And that was one of the things that once the machine is in place and you've started to demonize these people and you've started to dehumanize them, then, you know, it people just join in and you're being paid by the government to do it. And it really shows that sense of almost like, you know, people will do what they're, you know, people will do what they're told to do, and often they're quite, their moral questioning will be later. But actually that does happen to one of our main characters. Well, not, he's not a main character and obviously he's deceased, but there was a man called Hugh McGuinness from County Down, and he took part in the Battle of Wounded Knee. But in 1969, decades later, he's kind of realizes like that was a genocide. And actually this before 1969, it's when he's in his 80s, he writes an account and he said the screams of the women and children followed him till the day he died. So I guess it is about that. You know, there are parallels with the modern world, you know, the good and bad in our own soul. And also, you know, this idea of once the machine decides people are going to be moved from a land, they're going to be moved.
So Ronan, as a final question, what would you like listeners, viewers to take away from the documentary, and what further stories do you think need to be told?
God, it is just be good to each other, isn't it? You know, when you see now how much, like we all know now the world's gone into a very strange place, and just, I think, you know, one of the things that resonates with me is that sometimes the soldiers would take Native American children and leave them where they know they would die from exposure. And that idea that, like, I kind of feel that we are who we are by accident of birth. You know, we just happen to be Irish, they just happen to be Native Americans.
Okay, Ronan, well, I think that's a very powerful message on which to end our discussion and indeed on which to end our show tonight. The documentary is Éire agus na Chéad Náisiún, Ireland and the First Nations. You'll find it on the TG Cathair player. And my thanks to Ronan McCluskey, the producer of that wonderful new documentary, for joining us. Ronan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéis O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.